think China is the biggest challenge in East Asia and quite possibly in the world outside of the United States.
We continue our look at the challenges facing the new U.S. president. This is Wednesday, January 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Remember, you can find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, the U.S. has a new Secretary of State. A continuing protest in India leads to chaos. The WHO questions whether one coronavirus vaccine will handle variants of the virus. That and more on today's VOA Asia. As U.S. President Joe Biden continues to settle into the White House, he faces numerous challenges when it comes to Asia. We at VOA Asia are taking an extended look at what he faces. For today's installment in our series, I spoke about U.S.-China relations with Jacques Delisle, law professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the director of that school's Center for the Study of Contemporary China.
Well, he faces a lot of challenges. I think China is the biggest challenge in East Asia and quite possibly in the world outside of the United States. And I think the problems come, or the challenges come from a few areas. Some of them are from the Chinese side. Constructive engagement is over, in effect. We now have a significantly rivalrous relationship. We've got security issues involving the South China Sea, Taiwan, espionage, things of that ilk. We've got economic issues like the trade balance, market access, industrial espionage, industrial policy that China uses to promote its own companies. And we've got a passel of human rights related issues, including Xinjiang and the Chinese repression there, the mess in Hong Kong with the national security law and the undercutting of movement toward democracy, perennial issues like Taiwan, questions of censoring communications outside of China on WeChat, China's export of surveillance and other tools of repression to other countries. So that's the China side. We exited the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations and process. We need to get back into that. Then finally, I think one of the things the Biden administration has promised to emphasize, in addition to repairing relations with allies, has been to restore American commitments and have them perceived as being serious in the region to values issues, to democracy, human rights, and things of it. And that's only a partial list.
Is a hard line against China a possible prelude of another Cold War?
Well, that's the concern. And I think one of the challenges facing the Biden administration, and one of the reasons it's good that they have people who have a lot of experience in these fields, is you've got to find the right zone there. That is, there's a much more adversarial cast to the relationship on national security, on national economic security, on human rights and other issues, a more adversarial tone than there was, you know, 5-10 years ago. And on the other hand, not sort of going to the extreme of getting into a Cold War, getting into a true ideational conflict. We have genuine conflicts of interests and conflicts of preferences, and we can work those out. I mean, it's going to be areas certainly of rivalry and non-cooperation. But if you get to the point where it's a contest between two rival ideologies, then it becomes much harder to find areas of compromise on conflicts of interest, and it becomes harder to achieve another part of the Biden agenda, which is cooperating where possible. So there are things like climate change, like global pandemics, where cooperation is possible and indeed essential. And that becomes much, much harder if you're busy trying to dust off the old U.S.-Soviet style rivalry. So there are some bright spots. There's an appreciation that there are areas of cooperation. There's a sense that we're not engaged in the kind of almost territorial conflict we saw with the Soviet Union. And despite all the troubles in the economic relationship, and they are many, it is a really robust economic relationship still. We're nowhere near full decoupling. And that gives some ballast to the relationship. There would be real costs to letting things get much more confrontational than they are.
Going back to that list that you spoke about just a few minutes ago, what is the most dangerous that you see? Is it Taiwan? Is it what might, or the South China Sea? What's the most dangerous?
In terms of things that could escalate into an armed skirmish, armed conflict of some scale, the security issues obviously are the biggest ones. It swings back and forth between being Taiwan and the South China Sea, and under some scenarios, North Korea. at the moment, I would say Taiwan is probably highest on that list, but the South China Sea could come back. In both cases, they are essentially territorial disputes in China's mind, where the U.S., from Beijing's view, the U.S. is interfering in China's internal affairs. And we also have a situation where we're seeing the militaries in play pretty close to one another, so the risk of an incident at sea or an incident in the air is higher. I think in the longer run, the basic issues in U.S.-China relations are not about those particular flashpoints, but they're about the big questions about how the U.S. accommodates a rising China and the degree to which a rising China is or is not inclined or sees itself as bound to or interested in really changing some basic rules of the game. I think one of the things that it would be good to see the incoming administration focus on is to cease doing needless damage to the kind of human contacts that help the relationship not go off the rails any more than it needs to. So I think it's been a very unfortunate thing that China has banned American journalists and that the U.S. under Trump has made life difficult or unappealing for Chinese students and scholars who want to come to the U.S. Obviously, on both sides, there are security concerns that have to be managed, but we're at the risk of cutting off the channels that are useful for communications below the top level of government and that keep each side informed about what's going on in the other country. And if you don't know what's going on, you're engaged in a dialogue of the deaf and the mute, and that's not good for stability in what's now the world's most important bilateral relationship.
Jacques Delisle, director of the University of Pennsylvania Center for the Study of Contemporary China. Make sure you're with us the next 2 days as we continue our look into the challenges facing the new U.S. president in Asia. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. President Biden orders changes in the way many Asian Americans are treated in the United States. China's president urges the world to come together to fight the coronavirus pandemic and warned against a new Cold War. Indonesia surpasses 1 million confirmed COVID-19 cases Tuesday, while deaths from the virus near 9,000 in the fourth most populous country in the world. A pro-democracy activist in Hong Kong is the latest to disclose that Chinese authorities questioned his family and friends in mainland China for information about him. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. This is VOA Asia. Antony Blinken has been confirmed as U.S. Secretary of State. Blinken won bipartisan approval in the Senate with a vote of 78-22. Blinken, a longtime aide to President Joe Biden, has served as both Deputy National Security Advisor and Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama administration. The incoming Biden administration will be one of the most diverse in U.S. history, as shown by Blinken. His backstory has roots in Russia, Israel, and Europe. Natalka Pisnia has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
This is a genealogy records book from the Ukrainian town of Peryaslav. In 1874, the Blinken family data was first entered here. Yankel and Rys had four sons and two daughters. The youngest son, Meir, who later emigrated to America, was born in 1879.
They came to Peryaslav from Zolotonosha, from the Kiev province. When they lived in Zolotonosha, their last name was already Blinken. Meir Blinken, the great-grandfather of Antony Blinken, spelled his last name Blinken, not Blinken, of course.
Nadia Lipes, Jewish genealogy researcher, explains that Meir Blinken eventually made his way to Kiev, where he marries 20-year-old Hanna Machle Turovskaya, daughter of an agricultural worker. In 1900, the young Blinken family celebrated the birth of their first child, Moses, who eventually changes his name to Maurice when he lives in the U.S.
Antony Blinken's grandfather was named Moshe, Moses in Russian. He was born in Kiev.
Three more children were born later, Solomon, Yaakov Gershel, and Victor. In early 1904, the Blinken family, including Moses, made their way to America through Hamburg and London. At the end of August that year, they would head to New York City.
And actually, Meir, in the records we found from Ellis Island, was pulled out of line. It wasn't from a medical condition. We only know that there's an X next to his name, so we don't know exactly what the reasoning was. But he was pulled aside for further questioning.
Mayer's sons married and changed their names. Solomon became Sam, Moses first turned into Morris, and later Maurice. Maurice had two sons. One of them, Donald Mayer Blinken, eventually became a U.S. ambassador to Hungary and also was the father of Anthony. Following a divorce, the future Secretary of State was brought up in Paris by his mother Judith and stepfather Samuel Pissar, a writer and lawyer and a Holocaust survivor. Anthony Blinken speaks French fluently and plays the guitar. And like many Americans, Blinken has many distant relatives, both in the U.S. and abroad, in places like Russia, Israel, and Europe. For Natalka Pisny in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, Malaysia said on Tuesday it has signed deals with two domestic companies to purchase 18.4 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines produced by Russia's Gamaleya Research Institute and China's Sinovac. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. In India, a protest by tens of thousands of farmers erupted into chaos as many protesters breached the iconic Red Fort complex. As Anjana Prasricha reports, the farmers have been camped along highways on the outskirts of New Delhi for nearly 2 months, demanding the rollback of three contentious farm laws.
Mayhem gripped the Indian capital for hours on Tuesday after farmers swarmed into the heart of the city and clambered onto the ramparts of the historic Red Fort. Police fired tear gas shells, water cannons, and used batons to disperse the protesters. The farmers had been allowed to hold a unique rally and ride on thousands of tractors on the city's outskirts to mark their protest against three new farm laws. But some groups broke police barricades and entered central Delhi. At Red Fort, the protesters waved flags of farm unions and religious flags and even hoisted some alongside the national flag. The historic building is of symbolic significance. This is from where the Prime Minister gives his annual Independence Day address. Shouting slogans against Prime Minister Narendra Modi, others tore through security barriers to march into central Delhi, where many government buildings are housed. Several prominent farm leaders said those who had breached the police barricades did not represent the majority. Farm leader Yugendra Yadav appealed to the farmers to return. He said, "We will only win if we conduct the protest peacefully. For 2 months, the entire nation and world has said that our strength is our peace. If we break this, we break our strength." At least one protester died and several police personnel were injured. Buses and police vehicles were damaged by protesters hurling stones. The chaos unfolded on Republic Day, which is marked with a military parade to mark the anniversary of India adopting its constitution. One farm union leader, Bhanu Pratap Singh, said antisocial elements had infiltrated the protests. Tens of thousands of angry farmers have been camped on Delhi's borders since late November, demanding the rollback of the three laws. The government says it will reform the agricultural sector, but farmers fear their livelihoods will be hurt. Sleeping in tractors, trucks and makeshift tents and cooking on the roadside, they have turned highways leading into the city into gigantic protest sites. Negotiations between the farmers and the government remain deadlocked. The government has offered to put the laws on hold for up to 18 months, but union leaders remain adamant that they must be repealed. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia, China and New Zealand signed a deal Tuesday upgrading a free trade pact that gives exports from the Pacific nation greater access to the world's second largest economy. All of the big stories come your way through the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. This is Business Scene. I'm Ira Melman. Japan saw the number of foreign visitors in 2020 plunge 87.1% from a year earlier, marking the largest decline that country has faced in 56 years, according to the Japan Tourism Agency. Japan had aimed to attract 40 million foreign visitors last year, but due to the coronavirus pandemic, the country only hosted roughly 4 million foreigners. As the government tightened entry restrictions in an effort to control the spread of the coronavirus last May, the number of foreign visitors plummeted 99.9% from the same month in the previous year to just around 1,600 travelers. Last December saw the number of foreign visitors climb to nearly 59,000, although that was still 97% less than a year ago. As a result, a lot of the businesses relying on tourism are struggling. Luxury shopping mall Giza 6 recently announced the closure of 15 stores, including some global brands, because of the lack of tourism. Seen as an effort to combat the low numbers of foreign visitors, the Japanese government has announced it will increase the budget for the 2021 Tokyo Olympics and the Paralympics by almost 400 billion yen, or about 3.76 billion U.S. dollars. The expenditure also includes an additional 80 billion yen, about 780 million U.S. dollars, added to the supplementary budget for the current fiscal year for epidemic prevention and control measures. Unlike many tourist hotspots in Vietnam, the Sun Dung Cave has withstood the pandemic fairly well. The San Dung Cave is the largest cave in the world. It is so large that it has its own ecosystem and weather patterns. Located in central Quang Binh Province, the cave was first discovered by a local forager in 1991, but the secret on the entrance to the cave stayed lost for another two decades. When San Dung was opened for tourists, locals became porters and guides. Some opened their homes to guests wanting a bed for the night. Today, the cave follows a high-end tourism model which provides around 500 jobs for the local community. Ho Khan, the local resident who first discovered San Dung Cave, wants to emphasize the importance of the cave.
I want to tell the young people and the tourists who visit Phong Nha that firstly, we have to protect the environment and natural resources, as it will be the benefit to our children in the future.
However, industry professionals are skeptical of some of the policies the government has made and say the government has ignored its own policies. Some are also concerned about the cave expanding into mass tourism, as it could harm the natural scenery. For Business Scene, I'm Ira Melman. Happening in Asia, China said on Tuesday it will conduct military exercises in the South China Sea this week, just days after Beijing bristled at a U.S. aircraft carrier group's entry into the disputed waters. Stay with us for the latest news from and about Asia at voanews.com and all of our digital platforms. World Health Organization experts say more clinical evidence is needed to know whether the Moderna vaccine protects against COVID-19 variants. The WHO's Strategic Advisory Group of Experts on Immunization, known as SAGE, has issued interim recommendations for use of the Moderna vaccine against COVID-19. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Health officials are concerned about the new strains of COVID-19, which recently were found in South Africa and Britain and have since migrated to other places. The appearance of these variants has triggered consternation and many questions regarding their potential impact on the efficacy of newly developed vaccines against the coronavirus. The U.S. pharmaceutical company Moderna announced Monday its COVID-19 vaccine appeared to protect people against the emerging strains. WHO Director of the Immunization Department, Vaccines and Biologicals, Kate O'Brien, says she is aware of the report. She notes Moderna, however, has just said it has the ability to modify the vaccine to work against the mutant strains, but has not actually modified it. She says more clinical evidence is needed to know whether the two-dose regimen of the vaccine protects against the coronavirus variants.
This is an area that we're concerned about, and I think the readiness of vaccine manufacturers and the preparedness that they have to potentially make modifications to the vaccines that they are continuing to develop is very welcome.
O'Brien says most of the available evidence indicates the vaccines in hand are an extremely valuable tool in fighting the pandemic and in ultimately crushing the virus. Based on current evidence, SAGE members recommend an interval of 28 days between Moderna's first and second shots. It says the interval between the two doses may be extended to 42 days only under exceptional circumstances. SAGE Chairman Alejandro Cravioto says the experts oppose the preferential vaccination of international travelers against COVID-19, given the limited supply of available vaccines.
We feel that unless the traveling is essential, people should try to stay home and keep the social distancing measures that have been put in place that have been proven to be much better to prevent infection than any other measure so far.
The WHO recommends pregnant women not to be inoculated with either the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines unless the benefit outweighs the potential vaccine risks. It cites as examples that vaccines would be beneficial for health workers at risk of exposure and pregnant women with comorbidities who would be in danger of becoming severely ill from COVID-19. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of people gathered in Sydney to protest against the mistreatment of Indigenous people in Australia as the country marked its National Day on Tuesday on the anniversary of the arrival of the first British fleet in 1788. Libby Hogan reports.
With rap lyrics calling Australia's National Day Invasion Day, thousands of people gathered in Sydney to protest against the public holiday on Tuesday. The date is a sensitive one. January 26 is the anniversary of the arrival of the British First Fleet to Australia in 1788. And for many Indigenous Australians, it marks the start of mistreatment of Indigenous people in Australia.
Power to the people!
For Elder Auntie Shirley, it brings a sense of grief.
This country is, was and always will be Aboriginal land. White Australia is, was and always will be a penal colony.
Every year, protests have grown, calling for the date to be changed. On Tuesday, some held signs saying, "Walking on stolen land," and chanted, "Always has, always will be Aboriginal land." Others took a knee. For protesters like Tara Dryden, the day was about showing solidarity to Indigenous Australians.
January 26th is rooted in Australian history. It's a stain on Australian history, and it's a time we make a movement for it. It's not the date to celebrate.
Authorities warned protesters that they risked arrest if they defied state COVID-19 health orders to limit gatherings to 500 people. But in a last-minute compromise with police, thousands were allowed to gather in socially distant groups in the Sydney Park as their annual march was called off. A handful of protesters were arrested, but the protest was largely peaceful. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said Australia Day represents how far the country has come since the first fleet arrived, and told a ceremony that, quote, "For better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to our modern nation began."
That was correspondent Libby Hogan. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Amy Hybels, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington.
stay safe, and enjoy the day ahead.